There's something about the Democrats. They tend to win an election every once in a while and then demobilize. For this stuff to really be effective, they'd have to use their bully pulpits and to educate the American people, to actually get up in front of them and have press conferences and explain to the American people that there is a neo-fascist white nationalist menace in this country. There has been for a long time. It reappears, but now it's really emerged like never before. You know, it did a little bit under Nixon, it did a little bit under Reagan, and then it did a little bit under Bush, and now it really is this menace. And every time it pops its head, it needs to be seriously crushed and smacked out because it's a malignant tumor that will only continue to grow.
Hey everybody, thank you very much for joining me for this episode. I speak with award-winning journalist, policy researcher, author, and historian Paul Street. He joins me to discuss the highly controversial and divisive Kyle Rittenhouse case and his subsequent acquittal, and along with providing a substantive exploration of the broad sociopolitical context of this trial, we also touch on the case of the modern-day lynching of Ahmaud Arbery and the recent conviction of the men that murdered him in Georgia, the concerted legislative push in Republican-dominated states across the U.S. to impose harsher voter restrictions and roll back reproductive rights on the national level, and what these trends mean for the upcoming elections of 2022 and 2024, and electoral politics as a whole. Near the tail end of the uprisings of the long summer of 2020, Kenosha, Wisconsin erupted into riots after the police shooting of Jacob Blake in August of that year. Days of rioting ensued. 17-year-old Rittenhouse, Trump-enamored and an aspiring cop himself, traveled to Kenosha, picked up an AR-15, and joined dozens of other well-armed white reactionaries, allegedly to provide first aid, clean up graffiti, and aid police in protecting the private property of business owners. But by the end of that night of August 25th, he had shot three men, two of them fatally. In this interview, Paul Street and I don't so much as dwell on the gruesome and often tedious details of the Rittenhouse case, such as whether the act of shooting three protesters could be justified as self-defense or not, but rather the broader context these events fit within, specifically how the veneration of vigilantes and so-called vigilante justice, which Rittenhouse has been applauded for within conservative, right-leaning spaces, speaks to how utterly fascist the conservative right wing has become. In the long summer of 2020, we witnessed police brutality on full display in the murder of George Floyd in May, and the subsequent riots and protests, and in conjunction, an emboldened vigilante far right came into fuller view with the well-armed militias that accompanied the police in their attempt to brutally contain a racial justice movement in all its wild forms. 2020 also saw the beginnings of a years-long pandemic we are still grappling with, and only 6 days into 2021, a deadly fumbling fascist coup attempt at the Capitol, instigated by Trump and his allies, weeks before the presidential inauguration of Joe Biden. Now, on the state level, Republicans have passed scores of laws to undermine the rights of the LGBTQ+ community, attack voter rights, cripple public health measures, censure public school educators, and set the stage for Roe v. Wade to be overturned by the conservative majority Supreme Court. The dismal performance of the Democrats, a party that currently barely maintains a majority in Congress, and the maneuvers and long-term strategies employed by the Republicans will lead potentially to a Republican majority in Congress and a Trump presidential win in 2024. The lame duck presidency of Joe Biden and an ineffective, self-defeating Democratic Party has been seemingly unable and unwilling to counter this on any fundamental level. And this is not surprising, but it must be noted. Now, what comes next is not pretty. The situation is complex, fluid, and dynamic, and many things are difficult to predict with any accuracy. But if we expect electoral politics to counter this lurch towards a kind of 21st century neo-fascism, we would be sorely mistaken in that assumption. How we approach what comes next must be practical, creative, and revolutionary. We must look at this soberly. Under no circumstances must we allow fascism to dictate our future. Voting may have served utilitarian function in disrupting the dominionist Christian right from molding this nation in its horrific image. But voting has always been a fucking joke in this country. And with the GOP's laser-focused efforts to further undermine any legitimacy voting may have had in unseating them from political positions of power, we must recognize the dead-end electoralism really is. And so that leaves the question of what to do next. If voting isn't going to solve the issue, which it never has, and if electoralism as a whole is a dead end, then we need to really recognize what it will take to protect our communities. Kyle Rittenhouse was a symptom of a deeper problem, of a deeper thing that is occurring in this country, this trend towards paramilitary forces working in alignment with police to quell any revolutionary potential that is emerging among the population in the United States. And this is as old as the country itself, but it's taken on a new energy, especially as the Republicans have fully embraced a fascistic aesthetic and fascistic policies. They are attempting, and I think they are going to do this rather successfully, attempting to make sure that what happened on January 6th will not be necessary, that the coup will happen formally. I would really ask if you want to learn more about Paul's work, you can go to his website, paulstreet.org. Everything you need to know about him will be found there. He also writes regularly for Counterpunch. Many of his pieces appear there, so I'll be providing a link to some of his more recent pieces regarding the subject around Rittenhouse in the description. And he is the author of 10 books to date. His most recent book that was released was titled Hollow Resistance, Obama, Trump, and the Politics of Appeasement. He has a book that's coming out very soon titled This Happened Here, Neoliberals, Americaners, and the Trumping of America. So I'll be providing information about that in the description as well. If you want to learn more about my work specifically, you can go to my website, lastbornthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you want to support my work monetarily, there's a few ways to do that. You can do that through a one-time donation. You can do that through PayPal or Venmo. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, or you can find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. If you want to sustain this work on a monthly or yearly basis, you can do that through Patreon. You go to patreon.com/lastbornthewilderness. One way that you can definitely support this work is by subscribing to the podcast, of course, sharing it with anyone that you feel would benefit from listening to this podcast. And if you listen to this podcast on Apple Podcasts specifically, please consider leaving a review, hopefully positive review, but please leave a review. That'll actually help this podcast gain more exposure on that platform, at least. So that's it, everybody. I really thank you for your attention with the interview with Paul Street.
Oh, I need to say, got it. I've never seen that before.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that's the new thing. Zoom, like, tells you.
My national NSA handler would do the same thing.
I know, right? We are recording this call. Do you consent? Oh, man. Well, yeah, Paul, thanks for joining me for this interview. I have been following your work for some time now. Felt it was time, especially after this Kyle Rittenhouse case and the fallout of that. Your analysis around that subject has been really great. I've been really wanting to talk to somebody who can not only talk about the details of that case, but fit it within a larger context. And so when we were in communication about doing this interview, I think I alluded to that somewhat in our communication. Yeah, there's a lot to get to, but you know, when we talk about Kyle Rittenhouse, I think everybody listening should already know some of the details of this case. But very briefly, a 17-year-old young man, I guess, 17-year-old at the time at least, traveled to Kenosha, Wisconsin during what were protests and riots surrounding the police shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man. He was shot in the back several times. This was, of course, during, as you've described it, the long summer of 2020 of the George Floyd uprisings. And of course, that sparked a lot of unrest in the city of Kenosha. We started to see various very well-armed militia groups appearing around the United States at a lot of these protests. We saw them appear in Kenosha. Again, Kyle Rittenhouse showed up allegedly to provide first aid and help clean up businesses and protect businesses with an assault rifle. it led to him shooting three individuals, two of them dying from that encounter with him. So, of course, he was eventually arrested, and we just recently concluded the trial in which he was found not guilty on all counts. Very brief summary. There's a lot of nitty-gritty details to that case. But again, we can get into that as much as you like. But I would really just like to ask, you know, what has been your general analysis of that case? How does that fit within the larger context of many of the trends that you've been writing about over the years?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of different from this Arbery case where we got a decent verdict, which the Arbery case in Georgia, you know, the three white vigilantes, both cases, by the way, armed white vigilantes. You know, the Arbery case seems more like a throwback case in some ways. It sort of takes you back to the Jim Crow era, which is not to say that it isn't also political and that the killers in that case weren't sort of motivated by the white nationalism that swept so much of white America in the last however many years. But the Rittenhouse case was really sort of explicitly a fascist episode. The Rittenhouse killing, the killing of Jojo Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber was really a very specifically kind of fascist thing. And incidentally, before I get a little more into that, I will mention that a lot of people don't know this. There's also a civil case in Kenosha. I have no idea how it's going to turn out, but Anthony Huber's family is suing the city of Kenosha. I think the county of Kenosha, the Kenosha County Police, the Kenosha City Police, for coordination with reckless, armed, dangerous, white nationalists, let's be honest, fascist paramilitaries. That coordination, that sort of cooperation between thugs and gendarmes and white nationalists on the outside and police authorities on the inside of government is sort of a classic calling card of fascistic kinds of developments. And one of the things that's very frustrating about the Rittenhouse case, among many things that were frustrating about it, including an absolutely horrible, a clownish right-wing judge and a not very exciting, I don't think, well-executed prosecution. But among the many things that was, and related to all of that was frustrating about it, was pretty much the inadmissibility as evidence, as part of the case, of the racism and the white supremacism and the connection with organizations like the Boogaloo Boys or the Boogaloo Bois, whatever the heck they call themselves.
Yeah. Boys,
and the
yeah.
Proud Boys, mm-hmm. and the politics of it, you know, the political motivation behind Rittenhouse. Kyle was a, from early on, a major MAGA guy, a Trump fan, very influenced by the racial nationalism of Donald Trump and his Trump-captured Republican Party. I have heard, I haven't substantiated this, that Kyle was seen or heard responding to the early George Floyd protests, photos in Chicago. Remember, Kyle lives in Antioch, Illinois, which is actually in Northern Illinois. So he's in the Chicago media market, watching Chicago news, no doubt. And then Kenosha is just right across the border from Illinois to Wisconsin, north of Chicago. But I have heard that he saw tapes of news clips of really large-scale George Floyd protests in Chicago in late May and expressed a desire to go down there with his AR-15 and teach these demonstrators a lesson. That really goes to motive. We know that when he arrived in Kenosha, driven there by his very strange mother, who seems to me that she might be a lawsuit target one day for her driving him up there and whatever influence she's had on him, she drives him up there. And is immediately sort of taken under the arm of the Boogaloo Boys, or whatever the heck it is they call themselves. And, you know, all these guys are a bunch of armed neo-fascist training in the woods, Wisconsin, Michigan style vigilantes who dream of a genocidal race war. Mm-hmm. Okay, these are neo-Nazis. I'm blanking, or you can find it in the reports. I'm blanking on the name of the particular Boogaloo Boy that sort of he collaborated with one. With an AR-15 fully loaded. I wish someone would talk about when exactly he took the safety off of this AR-15 fully loaded with 30 full metal jackets. What to protect a used car dealership? Because young Kyle would wake up in the morning and after tossing in his sleep the night before worrying about the property rights of small used car dealer owners and Kenosha, Wisconsin. No, there with the explicit purpose of confronting an anti-racist protest movement. In the wake of the hideous racist maiming and paralyzation of the young Black man, Jacob Blake, by the Kenosha police officer, white police officer, Rustin Shesky. They said that Kyle was clearly up there in a political kind of way, in a neo-fascistic kind of way, as a Trumpist armed member of the so-called Kenosha Guard, the so-called well-regulated militia, that the NRA likes to talk about, up there as part of a response to the what I call the George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Jacob Blake rebellion of May through August of 2020. That's why he was there, and that really couldn't be part of the trial. And as a consequence, everything just revolved around these very small, legalistic self-defense details. And there was a sort of semi-plausible, when all the context is just blown up and thrown away, you know, there's sort of a semi-plausible self-defense argument. You do have some threatening actions and statements by Jojo Rosenbaum, who has a very checkered past. Then, after he kills Rosenbaum, he's an active shooter, and people are chasing him, which is their right to do, incidentally. It's your right to try and intervene in a crowd situation against an active shooter. But you just look at the jury was just shown these clips of Huber coming after him with a skateboard. Yeah. Heroic act, a legitimate act, an attempt to stop an active shooter, but it could be at some level semi-plausibly sold to this all-white jury as an attack on poor young 17-year-old inexperienced Kyle. Never mind that Kyle has no business. He's got an illegally owned gun. He has absolutely no business being in this situation. He's like some kid who jumped with an armed weapon into the polar bear display at the zoo and then wonders why the bears are snarling at him and then has to shoot a couple of them dead, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a bad analogy because this is about human beings and this is about white nationalism and this is about politics, but you get the point. He's got no business in there, but they could sell this semi-plausible thing. And then one thing that really hurt the prosecution up there was on the Grassowitz guy. I'm mispronouncing his name, no doubt. The guy that lost part of his arm admits that he pointed his gun at him. And he pointed his gun at him. And so, you know, and then Kyle is just so baby faced. You know, it's kind of like these guys down in Georgia are older, more skilled and came across as much more culpable. Sort of their sneering faces. One of them was an ex-cop. And then the ex-cop's son, who actually pulled the trigger, I think had a military background. They sort of seemed like people who knew what they were doing and had an intent. They had stalked a guy, you know, in a pickup truck and hunted him down. And Kyle, with his baby face, really not knowing what the hell he was about and having no business there at all, was frightened and blah, blah, blah. So the whole context is gone. And, you know, really the people who pulled the trigger is the broader fascist movement, the Boogaloo Boys and the Proud Boys. By the way, Kyle posed with the Proud Boys later. This was viewed as inadmissible evidence and made the OK white supremacist hand signal with them. You know, the Proud Boys, the Boogaloo Boys, and really none other than Donald J. Trump and right-wing talk media and Tucker Carlson. When you think about it, poor little 17-year-old Kyle was just sort of a pawn in this broader context of white nationalist violent reaction to a great human and civil rights uprising in the late spring and summer of 2020, you know? I mean, at the end of the day, I sort of like to take the focus off of Rittenhouse a little bit because, I mean, he's really kind of a pathetic character. Obviously, comes from a horribly dysfunctional family, you know, and is surrounded by just idiots, and ends up sort of being their patsy, and now, of course, he's been interviewed on Tucker Carlson, and I believe he's been down to Mar-a-Lago. More proof of my thesis, this is really part of the white nationalist problem in this country. And also the gun problem, obviously the gun problem, the Second Amendment problem in this country.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, I wanted to actually talk about that a bit because when you were speaking there, I was thinking about how, I wish I could remember her name. She was in the January 6th Capitol riot coup attack.
Ashley Babbitt?
Ashley Babbitt, right? She was shot by one of the police officers that was defending, was it the Senate floor? I believe so, yeah. So she was shot. She died. She became something of a martyr within this sort of neo-fascist movement here in the U.S., just like those that are being imprisoned currently for their involvement in that. They're being seen as like freedom fighters that are being, you know, imprisoned by this horrible deep state. Yeah, and then you've got Rittenhouse now that he's on his, he's now probably going to have a book deal and, you know, he's going to be interviewed on Fox News probably regularly. And he's now become a martyr, or even though he hasn't died, of course, but he's been, you know, a figure in this.
Maybe he can appear alongside Glenn Greenwald. On
right. I could imagine that will happen in due time, you know.
Right.
So I guess this is the question I have for you is the role that these individuals that have been elevated to the level of martyrdom. The role that plays in this sort of fascist narrative that has been building. I mean, the great lie, or the big lie, I guess it's been called right now, that Trump's the election was stolen from him and all of this. And now a part of the big lie is the idea that the Capitol riot was not instigated by Trump, but that it was actually the FBI or some like weird false flag event or something. I mean, that's now the narrative that's been conjured up. So I guess the question I have for you is like how these fascist movements, they take these individuals or they take these events and they turn them into something else. And if you could talk a bit about the how.
Well, they, you know, this is this is really a recurrent theme in fascist politics. It's sort of part of the fascist political playbook that the aggrieved and supposedly stabbed in the back ethnic, racial population that the fascist movements are upholding are the real victims. They're the true victims, not the people actually living at the bottom of the deep wells of race and class inequality in the country. But no, these heroic whites who hearken back to the noble founding of the great but aggrieved fatherland. I'm trying to remember the name of the guy that was killed by an anti-fascist in Seattle in the late summer of 2020. I think his last name was Danielson. He was with a Christo-fascistic organization called Patriot Prayer. And Donald Trump, still not unelected, still prior to the election, was, you know, grasped on this Danielson guy immediately as a martyr for the cause of aggrieved white America and damn near ordered, as far as I can tell, a sort of federal-led fugitive task force hit on, was it Michael Reinhold? I always mispronounce his name. Reinhold.
I believe that's it.
Who never drew a weapon or anything and was just pretty much just shot in cold blood. I think it was in Olympia, Washington.
Yes.
So Danielson was an example of that. You know, this interesting right-wing writer named David Frum, probably getting his first name wrong, I think it's David Frum, writes for The Atlantic, and he was a George W. Bush speechwriter. And he did a piece after the Ashley Babbitt martyrdom, so-called, in which he decided that he was giving up the ghost and decided that Trumpism really is fascism, which is something that me and a number of writers at Counterpunch and elsewhere and at the organization Refuse Fascism, where I sit on the editorial board, you know, we've been saying that from the beginning about the Trumpist movement. Frum finally got it. And what did it for Frum was the analogy that he saw between Trump's embrace and martyrization of this election assaulting military veteran, Ashley Babbitt, who was, I hate to say it, was tragically, but somewhat legitimately killed to keep her out of the Senate chamber where her and hundreds of others were threatening to invade and actually kill elected officials of the country. And anyway, in any event, I digress. Saw a very strong analogy between the martyrization of Ashley Babbitt by the right and the Nazi Party's martyrization of a Nazi cadre named Horst Wessel in the early 1930s. And it's the same sort of thing, a violent thug embracing a sort of calling card of fascism. Lawlessness, of political violence in the name of law and order. shot down. And I'm, you know, it hasn't happened with Ashley Babbitt, but Horst Wessel became this, he was killed by communists at some point in the early 1930s. Uh-huh. He probably deserved it. I mean, there was a lot of street battles between Nazis and communists in the early 30s Germany. And he became this holy type of figure. In fact, everyone, when Nazis would come into town squares, everyone would be forced to sing the Horst Wessel song. And from a neoconservative right winger was struck by this analogy and the disconnect between calling in the wake of the George Floyd rebellion, when Trump sends out a tweet that says when the looting starts and the shooting starts, he's okay with the shooting of Black people who are accused of breaking into stores to get food items that they can't afford, but he's aggrieved about the shooting of someone who was trying to physically assault and overthrow, you know, a sort of normal bourgeois democratic election, you know, and this is a key calling card. If Rittenhouse, he would have been an extraordinary martyr if he'd been proven guilty, if he'd been found guilty, he would have been that. I think probably these Georgia killers are just a bit too, classically throwback Jim Crow era hunt and kill racists with ugly sneers on their faces. A little less defensible that way. There's a little bit less of that political energy about that case. I can't imagine if they had been set free, that they'd be on. Of course, I could be wrong. I actually very well could be wrong with this, but I think they'd be less likely to be, taking a trip down to Mar-a-Lago to have dinner with Donald Trump or Tucker Carlson probably would want to have him. Tucker Carlson would do that. I think he would. He'd like him. He'd make heroes out of him. But yeah, Kyle's he's a hero, you know, for a certain portion of the population. And it has to do about race. It also has a lot to do about guns. Of course, both of them are connected. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to speak to you. You mentioned earlier, you mentioned Glenn Greenwald. And I'm interested in these figures who seemingly got their start politically. I mean, when we talk about their political writing, whether there was value in it or not, earlier on, they've moved or have drifted increasingly to a right-wing position. Greenwald is one of them. Matt Taibbi seems to be another. Jimmy Dore, he's a commentator. I don't know. There might be other figures who maybe were never actually leftist, but or progressive in any way at all, or even liberal, but they've increasingly taken on a right-wing position.
Joe Rogan.
Yeah, Joe Rogan's one that comes to mind.
And actually, I learned recently maybe Ted Rall, who really surprised me because I used to work with him. He used to have cartoons attached to my initial essays that I did in the 90s at Z Magazine.
Interesting. Okay.
It's through the Iraq War, and he's sounding anti-vaxxy and pro-Kyle and seems mystified that white people have, on the left have turned on Greenwald, as if that's mysterious. But of course, we haven't gotten to that yet, have we?
I'm curious what function they serve. I mean, I'm sure you've spent, I know you've written quite a bit about these individuals.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'll leave it there. I'll ask.
Well, I wanted to say actually some of us think that maybe he's actually returning to form. He was always kind of a right-leaning libertarian, and he first broke in the public sphere as the rather aggressive lawyer for Illinois Nazi leader Matt Hale back in the day, and admits in one of his early books that he was initially a supporter of the invasion of Iraq, which is sort of astonishing here for a lot of us. But libertarianism, which I think is ultimately tends towards the right, is capable of a lot of sort of shark jumping and shape shifting and things of that. There were a lot of, I've been kind of a lightning rod for a lot of these folks because I was such a strong critic of the Obama administration and the imperialism and corporatism and fake progressivism of Obama. And a lot of the left was, a lot of the real left was. But I used to hear from a lot of these folks that were in that kind of vein, but they never seemed to understand that real left thinkers aren't partisan. Our public enemy number one for us is generally whoever happens to be sitting atop the American empire. And so something very odd happened with the shift from Obama to Trump. And they're so alienated by, and I understand a lot of the alienation. I've written a lot of stuff that would help explain the alienation. I've experienced a lot of the alienation myself. But they're so alienated by what the Democratic Party has become and how the Democratic Party has become captured by the ruling class. I mean, has become captured. I mean, I'm a historian. You could sort of argue that it's always been the case. Yeah, but the neoliberal takeover, the full-on neoliberal corporate takeover of the Democratic Party under Bill Clinton and under Barack Obama has certainly caused some legitimate alienation, but then it becomes so, and the kind of fake anti-racism, sort of inauthentic anti-racist, insincere anti-racism of the Democrats, of the neoliberal Democrats, has created a kind of situation where a number of people that I thought I understood, or with whom a lot of us on the left in the Obama years that we were allied with, a lot of those folks seem so obsessed with owning the libs, that's how they put it, own the libs, that it distorts their mind and they become incapable of seeing the danger on the right, which is one kind of problem when the right is just sort of the traditional nasty corporate Republican Party. When that party has jumped the shark and crossed over into white nationalist, anti-rule of law, anti-electoral democracy, when that party has really started breaking with longstanding bourgeois democracy and constitutionalism and embraced violence and embraced full-on eliminationism. And it's calling for the elimination of all political opposition. When that party has started referring to all of its enemies as scum and as vermin, when it starts talking about the inner cities and the urban areas as infested by, you know, inferior criminal, animalized, you know, non-white others, when all those things, if I could go on and on with it, when that party has crossed in that kind of space, and it has now, this whole Tweedledee and Tweedledum, you know, standing above it and looking at it and saying the Republicans and Democrats are the same exact party, and they're like, they're both awful and they're both authoritarian, but at least Trump is honest, you know, and that becomes very problematic. They're not the same. But the reasons that they're not the same is not because, in my opinion, is not because the Democrats are really any damn good. They're not particularly good, in my opinion. But because the GOP has become so absolutely horrific and neo-fascist and white nationalist and violent and eliminationist, if that makes any sense. I had something more to say about that, but the thought just flew out of my brain. It'll come back if you ask me some more.
Oh, yeah. It was more about, these. And what I see is that the right, this thing I've observed, well, it was happening before Trump, but I feel like it felt more accelerated under Trump because he was such a visible representation of a lot of the values that people have on the right. But the right-wing media ecosystem is a very profitable space if you can.
Yes.
You know, so like if you're Greenwald or if you're any of these other figures, I feel like it's just a very cynical, calculated move. It's like, I think you mentioned this in a previous interview I listened, where you have like Fox News, right? They're pushing and they're agitating this sort of anti-vax, COVID denial kind of thing. And at the same time, everybody that works in Fox is vaccinated and they all wear masks as a part of like a company-wide policy. So there's this split, right, where their actual actions do not match what they're spreading on their news network, so-called news network. And I see that a lot. I mean, like Trump's vaccinated and he even said it once at one of his rallies and everybody booed him, which was an interesting thing to see. So it's like they understand that they don't want to get COVID, right? I'm just using this as an example, but there's a very stark thing there that can be observed where what they're promoting, it does not exactly match what they're doing on an individual personal level.
No, I think you're suggesting a missing part of my discussion of trying to explain these guys.
Yeah.
It's a really key point. You're absolutely right. They are, for the most part, grifters, and they're cashing in. I mean, that's fine. We've many of us on the left have announced our divorce with them. They don't care. They're crying all the way to the bank. I mean, Jimmy Dore is is kind of a mediocre comic who's found this as a kind of market space and anti-vaxxery and anti-racism and sort of playing footsie with white nationalism and referring to Tucker Carlson on a first name basis. And I think he at least has been on Carlson at least once or twice.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, when you shift over and you read the winds, that's where the money is, you know. And I think that's true with Greenwald, and I think that's maybe even to some extent what's happened with this guy Ted Rall, who I recently saw on social media being anti-vaxxy, being supportive of Rittenhouse, you know, which is just a really odd thing for somebody on the left. There's one of the many connective narratives and links between and amongst these people. They're in what I call the Trump and left. Which at first, when I made up this term, I thought it was kind of a joke. And then it turns out there's just a lot of people who really kind of are, oddly enough. They're kind of a white grievance or a white male grievance left. And they're a Trump and left. One of the connecting links amongst a lot of them, and this even goes over to this guy, remember What's the Matter with Kansas? Thomas, What's the Matter with Kansas Frank? And even a Crystal Ball. There's this kind of innumerate myth, because they don't do social science and statistical analysis, and they don't have a lot of respect for it. They believe that the Trump base is a lot more proletarian and a lot more working class than it really is. And it's sort of, this is part of how they simultaneously kind of say that they're Bernie fans and that they wish Bernie had been the candidate. And they have this notion that there are millions and millions of the so-called white working class that really wanted to be progressive, you know, and really wanted to be social democratic, but then they were betrayed by the Democrats. And then they went over and played footsie with Trump, who's supposedly a populist. He isn't. He's a fake populist. He's a fascist. You know, and so they do this kind of Trump and proletarianism, I call it. They have this stuff. And all of the actual data, actually all of the social scientific serious research into this finds that it's the Trump base, the Republican base, is not particularly proletarian. The Republican Party today is not a blue collar protest party, not even remotely. It's in many ways still the sort of traditional Republican constituency. It's more affluent than the Democratic constituency. It's rural, and it's outside the metropolitan areas. But even when it's rural, it tends to be more affluent segments within the impoverished rural parts of the country. It's actually quite suburban as well, and it's very tricky. It's tricky stuff, but it's not that this is not the working class. The working class is not, but they run with that narrative, and so you'll see a guy like Taibbi or Dore or Greenwald or now Rall positing that public health vaccine mandates and masking mandates are like bourgeois elitist assaults on the the virtuous working class. And it's really kind of goofy stuff, but it pays. And, you know, it plays right into Republican propaganda, because the Republicans love to brand themselves as a populist party, as a party of the people, over and against the elitist Democrats. And the Democrats are elitist, but they also have a whole hell of a lot of poor people in cities in their constituency. And overall, they're more working class and more impoverished by far than the Republican base and the Trump base.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I would like to... We're talking about Rittenhouse a bit, and I know he's just a shitty individual to focus on, but you know, he is a bit of a catalyst figure, and so I want to speak about him almost as an archetype, not as much as an individual. I don't care about him as a person.
Right.
To me, what's more interesting, and the same thing goes for Trump, is that they're symptomatic of something bigger that's happening here.
Yeah.
But you know, this sort of reactionary right wing politics, this thing that I'm seeing more and more is being spoken outwardly. One is is that sort of like, you know, we're going to protect property, quote property, but by any means necessary.
Yeah.
And we saw numerous examples of this during the protests last year. But also like how this has been so mainstreamed into electoral like, what was his name? Gozar. I think his representative in Congress was censored recently because he had shared a video, was like an animated video of him or whoever killing AOC and these other like progressives in Congress. Like the sort of normalization of the brutalization and violence towards the left, or not even the left, but people that are considered on the left, because the left is almost what they call the left is. Anyway, that's a whole other
Joe side. Biden and Joe Biden's Trojan horse of socialism.
Yeah, he's a communist secretly or something.
Well,
right?
That's Kamala. She's the Marxist feminist.
Okay. So there's this narrative that's being generated, and I feel like Rittenhouse, among so many others, are just figures within this broader narrative, which we alluded to earlier. And I think these grifters that we mentioned earlier, like Greenwald, are helping because it's dividing the left to a great degree as well. I think it's helping kind of cement the right wing's agenda in many ways. I think that they're serving that. So I guess, this is what I really wanted to point to, and this thing that you talked about in your interview with Chris Hedges, and I thought this was a very valuable point because I'm seeing legislation being passed in states all across the U.S., where it does feel like we're living in two different countries.
I'm
from Southern Idaho. I moved up to Northern Washington just about 3 months ago. I know that you travel between two different cities, and you've mentioned this as well. Like just with COVID and how it's treated, it's a completely different world. Living in Idaho, it's as if it didn't exist. Of course it did. The ICUs were completely packed for months. We had crisis standards of care in ICUs in Idaho for months. So it's very real, but people didn't treat it as if it was real. I would be the only one wearing a mask in a crowd. And coming to Washington, where it's actually treated as if it is real, even if people can be occasionally lax about it, nonetheless, it's much more common to see people taking it seriously. So my point in saying that is that it just feels more and more legislatively, culturally. We've always had a cultural divide in the United States, but it just feels like really we are reaching some critical moment here. And so I really want to talk about that and how how like what the direction you feel is we're going in. I mean, you can just speak at least legislatively across the U.S. and what that means for the election.
You mentioned a few things in there that I want to chime in along, which is the normalization of violence. I've never seen anything like it. It is the election officials at the local level, at the county level, and at the state level, particularly in red states, not exclusively in red states, now just routinely get death threats. Public health officials now routinely get death threats. School board officials, I think largely over vaccine issues, but sometimes even over the insane claim that critical race theory is being taught to kindergartners and first graders in local school districts, get violent harassment and get death threats. The one that really got me lately was school nurses. I was listening to the radio the other day, and school nurses under attack. Well, why? School nurses, make the calls to parents when one kid tests positive for 19, then they do the contact tracing and they start calling people and said, you need to know that your kid was in contact with blah, blah, blah. And they get cussed at and they get yelled at and get screamed at. You know, store managers, the New Pie Co-op in Iowa City just decided to let a few people go around maskless because that risk was considered less than the risk of teeing off some people who will come back at you with guns, you know? Yeah. And you hear this all the time. You hear about retail store clerks. So that's really going on. One thing to keep bear in mind too about the violence is that's afoot and that the right wing is promoting is the vigilante nature of some of the violence. These were vigilantes in Brunswick, Georgia. All these vigilantes supposedly there to protect property. In Kenosha, they were not actually state people. This insane bill that was passed in Texas, SB8, is actually sort of in a vigilante style, as an end run around Roe v. Wade, empowering people privately to sue anybody. And by the way, they can do this anywhere in the country, to sue anybody involved in any way with an abortion. in that state, a lot of legal observers have made a analogy between that and the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, which empowered, you know, private actors to go up into northern states and physically, as vigilantes, haul them back. And, you know, on the red state thing, you're absolutely right. I'm back and forth between Chicago and Iowa City and the different worlds that you cross into. And, you know, Iowa, by the way, it's just really awful, too. It's sort of underestimated, maybe because it just has 3 million people, but it's really extraordinary. It's not a southern state, and it goes beyond a lot of southern states in the depth and the degree of the right-wing legislation it has passed, and the Republicans are in complete trifecta control of Des Moines. It's just astonishing. But when I cross from Illinois across the Mississippi River on an Amtrak train into Iowa, I go from a state where I'm mainly in Chicago. I don't spend a lot of time in the interim between, let's just say Chicago. When I go from Chicago to Iowa, I go from a place where teachers are in the public schools are going to talk honestly by and large measure, certainly in Black schools. My younger Black friends tell me that they do in Chicago public school about race and about slavery and about that history. And it's actually now technically illegal in Iowa. It's one of like 14 states that has passed bills prohibiting. Actually, critical race theory isn't in the bill, but the way it's outlawing honest discussion of history, of Black history, of the significance of slavery and Jim Crow and racism to the rise of the country. And incidentally, this is not just the bill in Iowa. It's not just K to 12, it's K to PhD. I mean, all public educational institutions. I'd love to see them try and enforce that at the University of Iowa History Department, you know, or the Iowa State, English Department, who knows, you know. So there's that. They got rid of pandemic unemployment benefits in Iowa. They didn't do that which is just vicious and just forces people back into dead places. They didn't do that in Illinois. Democratic state, they passed a bill that makes mask mandates illegal by local school districts. They've passed a bill that has drastically upped penalties for protesters, blocking roadways in any particular kind of way, which is what people do when protests get serious. They get out in the streets, you know, and just down the line, there's an incident in Iowa at the University of Iowa that a professor wrote about in the New Yorker while they were interviewed. That just would never happen in Chicago. A problem. I mean, at the University of Iowa, you can't even ask students as a professor to wear a mask in the classroom, to practice social distancing in the classroom, or you can't even discuss COVID-19 in any kind of real substance kind of way. And you can't even ask a kid to be masked during an office hour, when they come into your private office. When I go into a grocery store in Iowa City or into a pizza place in Iowa City, after I've been in Chicago for 3 weeks, it's like COVID culture shock. You wouldn't go in a Trader Joe's or a Jewel Osco or a Whole Foods in Chicago with the mask on. You wouldn't even think of it. You'd be violating local mandates. I went in to get a pizza from Pagliari's Pizza in Iowa City where people were just jammed in. I mean, there must have been 150 people. Yeah. I ran in there with my mask on. I looked at me like I was a Martian, like I was some sort of freak. No, I'm just a guy from Chicago. This is what we do.
Yeah.
And I got my pizza and I got the hell out of there. And I mean, I looked around and I mean, it was like being in another planet. It's just COVID cuckoo land. And so we do seem to just live in different worlds now, you know, and those other worlds are not quite, it's rural versus metropolitan. It's to some extent south versus north and west, but it's not as clear cut a division. You hear about partitioning and secession, but it's not 1860. We don't have one particular society and a particular mode of production called Black chattel slavery inserted within the larger world capitalist system in the South, and then another free labor entrepreneurial pre-corporate becoming corporate capitalism in the North, you know, with a free labor ideology, you know, from Massachusetts all the way out to Nebraska above the Mason-Dixon line, and a paternalistic Christo-racist slave system and ideology on the other side. No, it's more like Yugoslavia now, you know, And I, you know, and that's why I held back a little bit from just making Illinois versus Iowa, because my friend Terry, who lives in rural Illinois outside of a small town called Dixon, reports that it's just what I described to you in Iowa is very much the case in, you know, we call all of Illinois outside of Chicago downstate, which is kind of silly, but that includes even northern Illinois. All of downstate Illinois, out of, you know, pretty much all small town Illinois is the same way. You're going to get, once you get out of Chicago, Chicagoans tell you this, once we get out of the city, you know, and you go into a gas station, you know, to buy something after you fill your gas, it's just, they look at you like you're crazy when you're wearing masks. And, you know, it feels like civil war to some extent. It feels like two very, very different worlds. And to some extent it is.
Yeah.
Some extent it is. I mean, I hear more people over the left, so I just don't want to live in this country with these people, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what they're saying on the right too. We don't want to live there. So, but how would secession look? I just can't even fathom that, where it's different now, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't feel like that's like, obviously that's not a viable thing, but right. What I see is, this is what I want to ask about the upcoming elections, 2022,
sure.
2024.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you made valuable points in your writing and in a previous interview I mentioned with Chris Hedges about how the Biden administration has ultimately, not only have they backed off numerous promises that they made on his campaign or even at the beginning of his administration.
Right.
But the ways in which he's dealing with this massive infrastructure bill is, you know, it's failed in many big areas. The pullout of Afghanistan, withdrawal from Afghanistan has been very sloppy and not very popular. His polls are not good. So again, this isn't about him, about us kind of liking Joe Biden, but you know, the alternative is a Republican, and considering the state of the GOP right now, it would be somebody either like Trump or Trump himself that would be elected in 2024. And we were just discussing some of the legislation in states around the U.S. and red states. So it seems to me that because the coup attempt on January 6th failed, they're now going to approach this sort of push from a different angle through legislation, which is to say that they want to make sure that they stay in power and that their agenda is pushed further and further. Which to me is it's a form of authoritarianism, you know. I'm kind of rambling.
Well, bear in mind that the January 6th riot, the Capitol riot itself, was in many ways a last ditch Hail Mary after what was hoped to have been a more formally constitutional and legal coup could have succeeded, and it might have had it been. Yeah. Closer. And I think the lesson of January 6th to a lot of them is that they don't want to have to go there next time. They want to rig this thing in advance. And, you know, bear in mind, and no one seems to want to talk about this ever, the system is already rigged.
Right.
This label on the charter from the late 18th century towards the right. I mean, every state has two senators, regardless of how many people they have. That is a huge, huge bias towards the most reactionary white and right-wing and rural parts of the country. I mean, my God, Wyoming has barely 600,000 people and two U.S. senators. California has about 40 million people and has two U.S. senators. So the right wing is drastically overrepresented in the extremely powerful upper body of Congress. The right wing is overly represented in the Electoral College, which is a winner-taker. It's complicated. One thing is, I always tell listeners, it's always interesting to try and explain the Electoral College to somebody from Europe, you know, or some other more nominally democratic country, you know, and they will just laugh. They will laugh at you. So you consider that a democracy? We don't have majority, one person, one vote election of the U.S. president. We have an Electoral College, winner take all, state by state electoral slate system that incorporates the overrepresentation that the Republicans enjoy in the Senate in the Electoral College formula. And the Electoral College formula also works in such a way as to concentrate the presidential election in just a small handful of contested states. You know, I could go on and on about that. So this time around, and this is part of a piece I wrote once called that what happens in the red states doesn't just stay in the red states. This time around, the right wing, which is much better than the Democrats and much better than progressives at understanding the importance of state level politics. State level politics really sort of tend to operate under the radar screen compared to both local politics and national politics. And the right wing and the Koch brothers and the American Legislative Exchange Council and the right wing policy networks have known this very well. And they are further rigging the game towards the right in numerous red states in the South and West and places like Iowa across the country with voter suppression laws, which are ways that make it tougher to vote, tougher to get registered to vote, tougher to count ballots. But not only the voter suppression, which is just endemic in the red states, in order to prevent another Georgia and to prevent another Arizona, you know, where swing states went Democratic barely instead of Republican. They're also carrying out a bunch of measures of election flat out nullification. They are working up measures whereby whole state level electoral slates can be negated by the Republican led state legislature. They are trying to create a system that it's just impossible for the Democrats to win the 2024 presidential election. And when you think about all the rigging that's going on at the state level and in contested states where Republicans have a significant amount of power, and the likelihood of the history says the Republicans will come back and take the House of Representatives and perhaps also the Senate in 2022, and certainly in 2024, Republicans have a good shot at the Senate, the likelihood of a Democrat squeaking by in the popular vote and or the electoral and the all-important electoral college vote, but then Congress refusing to certify and it getting thrown back into the House of Representatives or to the Supreme Court and handed to the GOP is extremely high. There's a coordinated assault on a normal bourgeois Democratic election in 2024, and the chances of Republicans coming back to power are very good. What happens in the red states does not just stay in the red states, and they know it. And so they know that a lot of stuff full of national political implications is going on in the red states. You know, when the Texas abortion bill and all the other abortion bills, like the Mississippi one, which is coming up to the U.S. Supreme Court very soon. The Mississippi abortion bill is crafted in such a way as to compel the Supreme Court to, which is now 6-3 right wing, to abolish the right to abortion on a national level. The Texas abortion bill was structured in such a way as to make anyone liable for a $10,000 or more lawsuit for aiding anyone in the country for aiding an abortion in Texas. When you blow up public health protections, masking and vaccines in Iowa, people get COVID and then travel. They go to the Hawkeye football game in Iowa City, and then they come back to their accounting job in the loop and infect people in the blue state, Chicago. You know, it's all interconnected.
Yeah. I'll ask you one final question, and this was just out of curiosity, but the January 6th commission. So, of course, there's been an investigation, ongoing investigation, I guess, into what happened on that day. Now they're issuing subpoenas for figures such as like Roger Stone, Steve Bannon, Alex Jones, many other individuals that were in some form or another involved in the planning of that. Mm. It's hard to predict, of course, but I mean, based on what's already been revealed, I mean, what do you think about this commission in a general sense, and what do you expect to come out of it in the coming months?
You know, it's really hard to say. I think the game here on the right wing side is to just appeal and appeal and delay and delay and try to get to the 2022 midterms, and then the game is over, and then the House committee is dismantled. And I mean, I hate to say that, and I think that there are some issues on the Democratic side that are sort of consistent with the longstanding appeasement role of the Democratic Party, which just is not about, just isn't about fighting. It isn't. There's something about the Democrats. They tend to win an election every once in a while and then demobilize. And then to really, for this stuff to really be effective, they'd have to use their bully pulpits and to educate the American people, to actually get up in front of them and have press conferences and explain to the American people that there is a neo-fascist white nationalist menace in this country. There has been for a long time. It reappears, but now it's really emerged like never before. You know, it did a little bit under Nixon, it did a little bit under Reagan, and then it did a little bit under Bush, and now it really is this menace. And every time it pops its head, it needs to be seriously crushed and smacked out, because it's a malignant tumor that will only continue to grow, you know. And they just don't want to do that, because that would lead to a mobilization of the populace, at least potentially, that they really don't want to see. That the sponsors and owners at places like CNN and MSNBC and their advertisers really don't want to see, because when you really mobilize the people about the depth and the degree of the authoritarian menace that they're facing, they start to raise questions of social justice and democracy and wealth inequality and plutocracy and ecocide and racist mass incarceration and patriarchy that, quite frankly, the Democrats aren't in any position to, and don't have any particularly desire to do so. I think that's part of it. That's the really sinister sort of take on it. And at the risk of sounding like I'm giving them any excuses, I think there's fear too. I think they know damn well that the system is rigged against them. Even before all the state level red state electioneering rigging, and by the way, the incredibly on steroids gerrymandering that's taking place right now in the wake of the 2020 census, as they're redrawing districts in a way that works even further to the advantage of the right wing. But with the system already sort of rigged in advance by the overrepresentation of the most reactionary parts of the country in the government, and the incredible bad fortune of Trump being able to appoint 3 Supreme Court justices. Now we have a 6-3 right-wing Supreme Court. And a lot of people don't think much about how many right-wing judges across the whole federal bench that Trump appointed. Just looking at the system, I think they figured that in a lot of ways, they're about to be the minority party again. And if they are really serious about punishing Trump, he's going to be really, and his party are going to be really serious about punishing them. You know, you don't have to be an elected member of the House of Representatives to be the Speaker of the House. There is one crazy scenario in which the GOP takes back the House in 2022, thanks in part to the incredibly uncharismatic Biden's low popularity numbers and the gerrymandering and other forms of electoral rigging of the House races, they take back the House and appoint Trump. I mean, maybe this is completely insane, but someone was floating this to me recently as their Speaker of the House, and whereupon they impeach Biden for made up alleged Ukraine crimes or something else, or for being a slave to China, or, you know, or they probably won't try Pizzagate. They probably can't sell that on a national level. Probably can't impeach Biden for running a global child sex and cannibalism ring. But, you know, Trump would like to be, he's a wannabe fascist dictator. And I think, you know, I'm a wild-eyed Marxist left radical. I don't think I'm that high on the list of the people that would be first gone after by a Trump for life or a DeSantis Pinochet style regime. I think that they'd be going after some sort of high profile liberal Democrats, right? You know, Schiff and who's the fellow in Maryland, Jamie Raskin and all these guys. I wonder if their passports are up to date and if they've thought about the residence overseas. I think to be real issues, and I think they know that. And particularly with all the violence afoot there, I think they're afraid that all hell could really break loose. So I think they're just sort of, they have to maintain some credibility with their base and maybe, you know, and seem like they're prosecuting a few people. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. I mean, I'd like to see real big fascist crime trials and incarceration. I mean, I if I was the king of the United States, Steve Bannon would be in Guantanamo right now. I mean, we'd never see the day of light again. I mean, these people are as Raskin referred to the Capitol rioters, Jamie Raskin, fascist traitors, absolutely fascist traitors. I mean, Bannon, Stephen Miller, their favorite novel of all time was The Camp of the Saints, which is an openly fascistic French novel about the swarming of Europe by diseased African and Indian immigrants that involves the use of violence to put them. Bannon is organizes and tries to link up with fascist movements on a global scale. He's in Europe. He's in Brazil. He goes to the Philippines and Hungary and so forth. This is a real thing. And if we want to incarcerate these people and fight them and deal with this menace afoot, at some level we're going to have to do what Refuse Fascism said, which was take matters into our own hands. If we're waiting for Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff and even Alexandria Cortez and Bernie Sanders to fix this situation for us, we're going to be waiting a very, very long time. In another lifetime, I was a historian. Nothing really happens progressively without people in the streets and in the public squares and in movements, not just spontaneously, but in highly organized movements like the Southern Leadership Conference that King was part of, like the CIO, and all of that. And we're very disorganized. And the right has had the streets, by and large, and the public squares since George Floyd, since there was Jacob Blake up in Kenosha. And then there was an Indian summer of the beautiful uprising of 2020. There was an Indian summer in American cities after Kentucky refused to charge the killers of Breonna Taylor. I remember that in Chicago. It was really significant. We had significant demonstrations here. And then there was a big celebration moment in the streets on the day that it was proclaimed officially by the Associated Press that Trump had lost, the Saturday after the election. Yeah. And since then, the streets have been owned by the menacing, armed, vigilante neo-fascist right wing. And that's a problem.
Yeah,
and the Democrats aren't going to call the people into the streets. Only the people can call the people into the streets. Yeah. Left movements and all of that. Yeah.
Well, I think that's the real menacing, ominous quality of the Rittenhouse case is, again, not about him specifically, about the idea that you could, under many circumstances, bring a gun to a protest as part of a right-wing militia and claim self-defense if you are to shoot so-called.
I think that's such a key point.
Yeah, and that's...
I think one pinch point or one key moment for when we may see real mobilizations is if, as many legal experts predict, a decision abolishing Roe v. Wade, overturning Roe v. Wade, comes out next June. That is, after all, half of our population we're talking about, the female half. And I don't think that's going to go down very well with millions and millions and millions of Americans.
Yeah,
We have to develop the capacity to mobilize. And we do have it when Democrats are in the White House. There's this odd pacifying thing, this illusion that things are okay because of Democrats in the White House. On the other hand, it can sometimes be useful over time. It usually takes a couple of years for people to see that, we elected a Democrat and everything, and life still sucks in America at the risk of, putting it crudely, and everything still sucks. That could be a wake-up call. It kind of was for the new left in the 1960s, And it kind of was at the end of the Bill Clinton administration with Seattle, with the anti-globalist, with the global justice movement. And it kind of was under Obama when Occupy Wall Street broke out. That was 3 years in, 2011. It kind of sunk in. First black president in the land of chattel slavery. Yay, that was cool. The rich have gotten immeasurably richer. People aren't even being thrown a lifeboat, and Goldman Sachs and Citigroup are getting bailed out, and he's drone bombing people. And there was kind of this wake up call. It's still a capitalist imperialist plutocracy. And we got to speed that process up.
Yeah.
This time, we need to get it that Biden said it when he was in 2019, he was talking to a bunch of donors in Manhattan. He said, I promise you, If you fund my campaign, nothing will fundamentally change. Nothing will fundamentally change.
Yeah.
That's a hell of a thing to say in a country where the upper, the top 10th of the upper 1% has as much wealth as the bottom 90%. Excuse me? Things need to fundamentally change. Yeah. But Howard Zinn, you know, I love the Howard Zinn quote. It's not just what it's not just about who's sitting in the White House. It's about who's sitting in the streets. The only reason I broke form and voted for a Democrat in this last presidential election was to give us some breathing room. Because you don't organize movements for social justice very well when the government is being run by people who'd like to put you in a helicopter and put a bullet in your head and throw you in a river, right? Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm not a Biden fan, but he's not a fascist, you know, and we a lot of us on the left and refuse fascism held our nose this time. I should have held my nose in 2016, but I didn't because I didn't take Trump seriously. It was a really bad mistake. Not that it would have made any difference because Iowa was going Trump anyway. But I held my nose this time because the GOP really is that old. It really is that bad. And it's really sad that we have the Greenwalds and the Doors and the others who can't get it, that it's not just about hating the Democrats and hating the liberals. You got to understand that other party, you know, they're like really important and they're kind of fascist now. That's key to the process.
Well, I really hope. I hope, and this is a hope and maybe delusional, but the idea that you talk about this few year lag there with electing a Democrat as president and having maybe a Democrat majority in the Congress. But, you know, people have gone through 4 years of Trump and they understand what that meant. And if they sense that not only has he not gone away, but that he may come back or somebody very similar to him will come back in 2024, we may see something like what you described. And that's, again, that's optimistic. But, you know, if there's this real sense that, you know, this isn't George Bush, who was horrible, obviously, but he wasn't a fascist or some other previous Republican president. This is somebody who is a demagogic, fascistic leader.
Yeah,
who is aspiring.
A wannabe dictator who wants a cult. Yeah.
And people know this. People are more aware of that than they've ever been because of the events of what led up to the, you know, of January
6th. Well, I think on the left, we have to think seriously about how to reject an election. Just because the right wing did that in a particularly insane kind of way. I mean, even without the rigging that's going on, and that's kind of an absurd thing to say because there will be a lot of rigging. But even without all the post-2020 rigging, the system was rigged. The Electoral College is absurd. I don't know why we've ever put up with it. It's utterly preposterous. I mean, even if there was no, I have no intention of honoring a 2025 inauguration of Donald Trump or DeSantis via even just the Electoral College itself. I find the whole process illegitimate. You know, I mean, as insane and crazy and loony as the January 6th Capitol rioters are, you know, they don't have a monopoly on projecting absurd electoral outcomes. The way to have gotten rid of Trump, this is what we say to refuse fascism. The way to have gotten rid of him would have, the best way would have been the way the people in Puerto Rico got rid of Ricky Rossello. Okay. That would have been the way to do it. That would have sent a message from the bottom up that we have an understanding of and a capacity for a people's politics beneath and beyond just these one holy days where we get to go in for 2 minutes and mark names next to ruling class candidates vetted in advance for us, you know, once every 4 years or once every 2 years. We have to have a politics day to day beneath the big money, major media, candidate-centered electoral extravaganzas that are sold to us as the only politics that matters. And I've got to say that right now, the Leninists here, the highly organized people, seem to be more the right. They never stop. They don't demobilize. They don't demobilize after they lose an election. They don't demobilize after they win an election. They just keep going. And they're very insidious and insane and nasty kind of way. I know too many liberals and Democrats who are just kind of like, oh, I voted.
Yeah.
You can't complain unless you've, have you heard that? Unless you voted, you can't complain. You can, you know, I vote, I complain. I don't vote, I complain. I mean, there's a lot to complain about. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I think that's a great way to end this discussion. And it was a very good, wide-ranging discussion with you, Paul. So thank you for taking the time. I just want to note here before we end this, you are the author of many books. I just want to mention your most recent book. Why am I not finding this? Hollow Resistance was the most recent one. But you have another one coming out.
Yeah, I was going to say Hollow Resistance was last year. Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and the politics of appeasement, which was selling pretty well until Trump lost and Biden won. But I argue that it's even more relevant now, because even though Biden won the election, we are continuing to see basically hollow resistance. We're still seeing it. We're seeing appeasement. Oh, yeah. We're seeing a Weimar Democratic Party that's functioning as an inauthentic opposition. It increasingly feels like Biden's just keeping his seat warm for Trump. But no, my next book is coming out at the end of December, and it's called, it takes its title to some extent from the old Sinclair Lewis novel from the 30s, but the novel, the historical journalistic monograph is called This Happened Here, Americaners, Neoliberals,
yeah.
And the Trumping of America. Mm-hmm. It's really fun. It's also a little depressing, but it's Routledge. Routledge Preston is coming out at the end of this year. So have me on again. We can talk about that sometime.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, yeah. Just ask people to check that out. Of course, you write regularly for Counterpunch as well. You have some really great pieces on the Rittenhouse case in particular, but just in general, the direction that we've taken in this country politically, socially over the past however many years. And you do that quite regularly. And publish there quite regularly. So I'd ask people to check you out there. Well, that is everything I've got, Paul. So thank you so much for taking the time to have this discussion.
Very good. You bet. Thank you.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to learn more about my work, you can go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you would like to support my work, there are a few ways to do that. The first thing you can do, of course, is subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is on numerous platforms, so wherever you listen to podcasts, it should be there. So consider subscribing. And if you would like to support this work monetarily, there are a few ways to do that. The first is through a one-time donation through PayPal and Venmo. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. Or you can find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. And if you would like to support my work on a regular basis, on a monthly or yearly basis, you can do that through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And if you support my work there, you will gain early access to these interviews before I release them publicly. You will find other exclusive content there as well. So to everyone that is a supporter of my podcast, however you choose to do that, thank you very, very much. If you would like to leave an audio message that can be featured on the podcast, you can do that through two means. You can call the phone number 208-918-2837 and leave a message up to 3 minutes long. Please let me know what your intention is with the message so that I can then choose to feature it or not feature it on the podcast. If you would like to also just go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com, you'll find a link at the top of the page that'll let you drop an audio file if that is preferable. And that is it, everybody. Thank you so much again for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a great week.